Do you really think you have a chance against us, Mr. Cowboy?
Yippee-ki-yay, motherfucker. Yippee-ki-yay, motherfucker. Yippee-ki-yay, motherfucker.
Stay with me. McClane! Stay with me.
Dad.
On your tombstone, it should read, always in the wrong place, at the wrong time.
How about yippee-ki-yay, motherfucker?
Hello, and welcome to The Collision, Collider's podcast about movies, TV, and more. I'm the site's managing editor, Matt Goldberg, and with me, as always, are associate editors Adam Chitwood.
Hello.
And Dave Trumbore.
Hi there.
Today we will be talking about Die Hard. We'll be talking about its importance relative to action films, its legacy, and then we will be talking about the newest Die Hard film, A Good Day to Die Hard. Sigh. All right, let's talk about the...
Don't doubt. What are we talking about again?
We're talking about A Good Day to Die Hard near the end of the show, and our... I don't know, maybe you liked it, Dave, I don't know.
I was just hoping that the topic had changed while I was spaced.
Apparently not. No, we're going to be talking about action films, we're going to be talking about... the thing is I, if you read the site, you saw that I did sort of a retrospective on the first four Die Hard films, because I find them interesting, because it's not a franchise in the sense of... of iconography. Not really. I mean, you do have Bruce Willis and you have his catchphrase. But John McClane, like, what makes John McClane John McClane, and what makes a Die Hard film a Die Hard film? Because it's not like there's an origin story or he has this special power or things that, like, it's not like Batman, where if you go to a Batman film, you're like, okay, I expect to see A, B, and C. Sort of, you know, it's that, like, when Kevin Smith was talking about Superman and the producer, John Peters, is like, I don't want to see him in the suit, and I don't want to see him fly. And it's like, well, then that's not Superman anymore now, is it? So
giant
it's that,
spider.
And a giant spider in the third act. But, so what makes John McClane John McClane? And I sort of came to the conclusion that, yes, there is a wisecracking personality there, but... it's also the guy who is reluctant, so that's sort of the Western cowboy part of the character, so he's the reluctant hero that we all like to see. He's also the guy that is afraid. There's also fear in him, and he is trapped. To me, those were the signifying markers of the best Die Hard films, namely Die Hard and Die Hard with a Vengeance. But Die Hard 2, I don't think is a bad movie. I just think it's a bit of a retread. But hey, compared to 4 and 5, it's a fucking masterpiece. It is water in the desert. But things seem to really go off track. And then there's also Die Hard as it exists historically and what it said about, you know, when it was made. And because it's a franchise that has gone across 25 years but has consistency because it has the same lead actor. Like, I don't know if you could – it's arguable if you could reboot Die Hard. But it's not like – the other thing about Die Hard is that it is pretty much an original. It was adapted from a book, but it's not like James Bond where you just sort of can have a character keep going and you identify them. But Die Hard, to me, I see something unique about that franchise, not just that it's been influential – but something that makes it stand apart. What do y'all think? What are your thoughts when I say Die Hard? What do y'all think about the franchise?
I feel like it's a story about a guy out of his depth. Like a not like an everyman, but just like kind of like a blue collar just guy that's just hanging out. He doesn't have superhuman strength. He doesn't have special training, and he's just trying to get through whatever's happening as best as he can. He's not using any like crazy trickery. He's not like a Sherlock Holmes who can figure stuff out really quickly. He's just a guy, and he's just at the end of the day having a very bad day. And I think that's what makes it relatable and what makes it interesting to watch, because this guy, well, he's not supposed to have superhuman strength or superhuman health qualities, but he's approaching every situation as if just kind of a regular everyday person would, and that's when kind of the humor comes in, because he thinks things are kind of ridiculous. But it also, I mean, going back to the cowboy aspect, he is the reluctant hero, and he approaches it with kind of that not cocky attitude, but the cowboy attitude of just kind of like, all right, if I'm going to handle this, I'm going to handle it my way, like not by the book or however way I can.
But there's also that sense of sort of honor and duty that comes with sort of the classic cowboy.
Western. Yeah, like and also that goes back to the everyman in that he wants at the end of the day, he wants to do the right thing, and like in the first Die Hard, like he would like to just save his wife, but you know he feels compelled to save everyone and do everything that he can to make sure everything's okay. But you can see on his face he's not like a rah, I'm gonna do it. He's like, ah.
Right, and also in the first Die Hard that I think people kind of forget about is that he doesn't want to do it all on his own. Like, he spends a lot of the film trying to get help. He tries to set off the fire alarm. He tries to call in a thing. He tries to call in an attack. He throws a body out a fucking window so that it hits a cop car just so he can get some help. It's not like, well, I guess it's all up to me. If anything, he doesn't want that, which I find to be one of the more endearing aspects of the character.
Yeah, it was definitely that, and then the elements of just the reality, the realistic situation that he was in. Not so much the terrorist angle of it, but the fact that he's kind of walking around. He doesn't have his own shoes with him. He gets kind of chased out of a room from gunfire, if memory serves correctly. And there was a reason he didn't have his shoes, which was kind of weird. But so now he's running around. He basically has no weapons. He has no shoes.
He has one gun, no shoes, no shirt.
Right. So, I mean, he's got, like, bare bones, sort of, like, he's trying to, like you just said, Matt, he's trying to get help from the outside because he knows he can't take down all these guys by himself, and he doesn't really want to. It's not part of his job at the time. So I think some of the more interesting and more memorable scenes are him dealing with these situations as best he can. You know, when he doesn't have shoes and he has to go traverse this room just covered in broken glass, that has nothing to do with being, like, heroic or a cowboy or anything like that. It's just a practical but very memorable scene that he has to deal with as the hero of this picture. You know, he doesn't have an endless arsenal of weapons at his disposal with unlimited ammunition. He doesn't have RPGs laying around or just a trunk full of automatic weapons. He's got, like, his gun with a few bullets and whatever he can get from the bad guys. And I just love the way they played that into the plot of the original.
And when he does find something big, he doesn't really, like, use it as a big plant. When he finds C4 in the original, he doesn't use it. He's like, this is going to be the key to finally bring on the terrorists. He uses it as revenge. He's like, oh, yeah, you want to do that? I'm going to strap it all to a chair, dump it down an elevator shaft, and blow you to hell out of frustration. Like, and I think, Adam, it goes to what you said. He's not Sherlock Holmes. He's not, like, some grand – I think he's a smart guy. He knows what to do in the moment, but he's not – yeah, he's street smart. He's not a grand strategist. He's not the guy, you know, looking to piece everything together. He is a detective, but not in the sense of, and now I will reveal to you how I pieced it all together. It's just he's just running frantically and picking it up as he goes along.
Right. So, yeah, the other great thing about the Die Hard series, I think, well, this is hit or miss, but some of my favorite parts of the Die Hard series are the villains, too, because the villains are more complex than they first appear. They have little twists that come throughout the plot. They're sort of this multinational at a point. Sometimes that works really well, 1 in 3. Sometimes that works horrendously. It just goes completely awry, as in this latest case. But those were some – at least it wasn't just a – you know, mustache twirling villain completely. They at least had a little bit of complexity and a little bit of, you know, ulterior motives to them. There was something that would throw you from what you would originally expect. And I always liked that in the series.
Right. Well, actually, I mean, we talk about them sort of being terrorists, but actually, John McClane never fights terrorists. He fights thieves that are masquerading as terrorists.
Exactly. Yeah, and then sometimes they have ulterior motives too, with obviously the big reveal in the third one. Not so much in the last one, but it's interesting that they just have these layers of, oh, we're terrorists. Well, not really. That's just to distract everybody while we steal a shitload of money. And then they also have some sort of personal stake invested. That's why I think Jeremy Irons in the third one was actually the best villain, even though Alan Rickman was a pretty close second in the original.
And Naked Bill Sadler is just a distant third. Adam, what were you saying?
Oh, I said blasphemy. Hans Gruber.
Oh, Hans Gruber. Now we're going to have
him. But another thing with the villains, though, too, is that they're memorable. Like Dave said, like they're not these mustache twirling villains. They have like a realistic aspect to them, but they stick with you, and that's not easy to do.
Well, there's also a dichotomy there. There's also something to say. This person is the polar opposite of John McClane. Mm-hmm. That if John McClane is the blue collar, you know, guy from the street who sort of flies by the seat of his pants, we're going to give him a refined European, meticulously planned, you know, a very smart guy. I mean, they're both smart. See, that's what they have in common, is they're both smart, but it's the way they do things. So, like, you have that great moment in the first Die Hard where Hans is like, we stick to the plan, and his henchman is, and if he alters the plan? Because that's what John McClane does. He improvises Hans' plans. It's that kind of, they go up against each other. And even in 2, you get the sense, I mean, it's not as strong there, but at least you have, again, you have the guys who are, Colonel Stewart is very regimented and very, down to letter. I think that's the thing, that John McClane says, oh, you have a very strict plan. Well, my job is to come in and improvise and see if you can hit it back to me. And that's
what I really like. Yeah, what another layer that I really like about the series is how smart they are relatively for an action movie.
By the way, I think we should challenge the audience a little bit too. I'm sorry, Dave, just to interrupt you quickly, because I think when we're talking about the series, I think we have to be very – are we talking – like there's 1, 2, and 3, and then there's 4 and 5. And so the
question I was going to break that down more.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, from my favorite ones from the series, which again are 1 and 3, they're smarter than your average action flick. They ask the audience to get invested. And there are very memorable scenes. One of my favorite scenes is from the original one, where McClane actually finds Gruber creeping around, and Alan Rickman as Gruber does this turn where he starts pleading with him and says, you know, he was one of the hostages. And meanwhile, the audience already knows that that's not the case. But so there's a sort of cat and mouse game that's going in between the two of them, between the hero and the villain masquerading as an innocent. And there's this great back and forth, and it just keeps leveling up the sort of the anxiety, the tension. And unfortunately, that's lost in the later movies. It comes back in the third one a little bit. The whole movie's a cat and mouse game. That's the fun of it. It's sort of this mystery, this puzzle to be solved, but it's also, you know, high adrenaline action the whole time. And there's great interplay between Willis and Samuel Jackson too, but I miss those elements. I feel like the Skip Woods and John Moore in this latest installment just looked at it as a cursory passover, and they were just like, oh, it's action. He's got this catchphrase, and a lot of stuff blows up. We don't need to worry about like cat and mouse games or any sort of like intelligence or investment from the audience. Just completely lost it.
Well, it feels like it's very clear within the series like which movies understand
right.
Understand what Die Hard – it's very easy to misunderstand what makes Die Hard Die Hard, and you could say like from like just a regular action movie fan's perspective, like, oh, John McClane, the PKA motherfucker. And then they might see the last two movies and say like, I didn't like him as much as the others, but might not be able to pinpoint exactly why. And I think that hits the nail on the head, is that, you know, these directors are going in with the same – mindset of just like, oh yeah, he has a catchphrase and he's just whatever, but they're not understanding what makes the character, right. What makes the movies fun and interesting.
And I would say
with the first and the third ones.
And I would give at least Live Free or Die Hard an edge, because I do think at the very least Len Wiseman appreciates the franchise. Like, he doesn't understand, that's sort of what's almost a little frustrating. He doesn't understand it. He doesn't understand what makes Die Hard, but like,
he doesn't understand a whole lot of anything.
But he is a fan of it. That's why. Actually, John McClane almost feels like a supporting character in his own movie.
Yeah.
Really, it's Justin Long is the protagonist of that film. And who is he? He's a guy that gets to stand around and admire John McClane. Mm-hmm. And then you get fanboy squared when you bring in fucking Kevin Smith to play Kevin Smith and be like, I'm Kevin Smith and living out a fanboy dream. Isn't that cool? Like, you fucking won a walk-on role. And it keeps going into that. Meanwhile, it was the first Die Hard film in 12 years, so there was also that aspect. It was a very different world that it had entered into. But at the very least, Live Free or Die Hard, I feel like its intentions are good.
And I also feel like I don't think it's a very good Die Hard movie, but for me, I like it more than most. I think it's entertaining. It's just an action movie. And I feel like a good Die Hard is not a good Die Hard movie, and it's not a good action movie. Like, I think that's where the difference comes in. I feel like Live Free or Die Hard, I was at least entertained, and I was enjoying the ride. I liked Justin Long. I like him as an actor. I think he's funny. And I liked, like, the way it was going. It wasn't a good Die Hard movie. It didn't – like you said, the John McClane character is a supporting role. But I feel like it's at least entertaining enough. Like, if it's on cable, I'll watch it. It's not something
it's
that
I'm like,
oh, I
hate that
movie.
It's a film where you could give it a bit more of a pass if John McClane wasn't in it. And also,
yeah,
if it didn't have the Die Hard – obviously, it wouldn't have Die Hard in it if John McClane was in it. But also, it's a PG-13 Die Hard
right.
film, which –
That was my question. Does he say his actual catchphrase in
no,
there? Is that
he
their
doesn't.
One use
it's,
of
– That's the one where –
Don't
it's
they get one fuck per nope. PG-13?
You can ask me fuck, but it has to be in the right context. You can't say
oh, so
fuck
can't.
In a sexual yeah. sense, and you can't
Got
say
it.
Motherfucker. So
also, if there's too much violence, then
if there's too much violence, so it's also it's a pretty bloodless Die Hard film,
right?
But yeah, at the end it's yippee-ki-yay mother, and then
explosion,
and then gunshot.
Yeah.
He holds. I don't care. Someone explained to me in the comments. I was saying how the way Timothy Oliphant holds Bruce Willis hostage in that scene to like basically Timothy Oliphant pointing the gun at himself, but into Bruce Willis. And someone's like, well, that's so he can push the gun into Bruce Willis's wound. And I'm like, no one cares. That's horrible. No one holds a person hostage while also basically holding themselves hostage. There's a billion ways to do that. He's like, yeah, just to maybe make him feel a little more pain. But yeah, I'm sorry. That's not – I mean, someone said that. I'm like, oh, I guess you're right. Now it's not stupid. I retract my point. But that's
the villain aspect of that movie is not very good.
It's not very good, but hey, at least it has a real actor playing it.
Yeah.
Has, and it has a villain, which yeah. is more than I can say for A Good Day to Die Hard, which has...
What the hell happened?
Exactly.
The carrot chewing and the... I don't even know what the hell
We'll get back
on.
To that. I keep feeling like yeah. we're just... I don't want to get there just yet, because I feel
no,
that
we,
there's,
yeah,
there's more to say about Die Hard, and I want to talk a little bit about the Die Hard legacy as
sure.
Adam, you know, you sort of started going into it about what is a Die Hard film and what is just an action movie. And so what is it that we expect from action, and what was sort of Die Hard's legacy after 1988? How did it sort of, you feel, did it sort of change the game as far as action films were concerned?
Well, we saw a lot more of, I mean, Die Hard was such a huge success. Obviously, studios wanted to repeat it, but it became – I mean, and it's still a thing where people describe a movie as Die Hard on blank or Die Hard in blank. We have two White House action movies this year called Die Hard – or that were described as Die Hard in the White House, Olympus Has Fallen and White House Down. And so I think it's not – it's kind of an overall term that doesn't really fit with every single – like you can't – like the – I'd like to say like the defining thing of Die Hard is that he's an everyman and he's a cowboy and he's in a situation out of his depth. And that kind of moves over. I mean, you see it a little bit in Speed. I mean, even though Keanu Reeves' character is like a professional, he knows what he's doing, it's still – I think you have that dichotomy with Sandra Bullock, and Sandra Bullock is more of the kind of everyman that's out of her depth, but she kind of rises to the occasion, not heroically, but because it's what she must do. That's what she has to do. I would go so far as to say Con Air might be another that kind of takes a little bit from Die Hard, and that it's putting people in situation like a single character, or in that case two characters, John Cusack and Nicolas Cage, in situations that are they're obviously out of their depth and they're trying to figure it out, and they want help. Like again, like you said, it's not people taking things as like a heroic stand. Like they're doing the best they can with what they have, but they don't want. They would like people, other people to help them. They're not going in gung-ho about it.
I also like the fact that those films are also rated R. I think the R rating really does help these action films that aren't based in superheroics, where it's like no one has a special ability. And so when it's rated R, you do have someone like Keanu Reeves looking at the bottom of a bus and he sees a bomb is there. And he's not going to go, golly jeepers. He's going to go, fuck me.
Yeah, I love that.
So that's – although actually now I do want to kind of see Golly Jeepers.
Just watch it on TNT.
Exactly.
Some of my favorite moments – this has nothing to do with anything, but some of my favorite moments from Die Hard with a Vengeance are the dubbings on like TNT.
Right.
Because at one point when Sam Jackson calls him a racist motherfucker, or Bruce Willis calls him – I forget what it was. It becomes a racist melon farmer on
melon
TNT.
Farmer.
And that's
well,
my
and the other one, one of the famous one is Yippee-Ki-Yay, Mr. Falcon.
Mr. Falcon?
And,
yeah.
And to me, if they were going to do that, they should have just named Timothy Oliphant's character in Live Free or Die Hard something yeah. Falcon. And then it would be Yippee-Ki-Yay, Mr. Falcon. And we could all groan harder. Oh, goodness. But yeah, no, I think the R rating helps. I think it, because it also makes it feel more realistic. And I think, Adam, that's what, you know, going to what you're saying, it feels more like a real person in that situation rather than someone who has.
Yeah, it's not like Rambo where it's like, oh, God, like this guy means business. Like those big, like Schwarzenegger, these like giant guys. These
are
kind of.
I have to argue that point because the original Rambo didn't really start out
like
that.
No, no. Yeah, right. Rambo is very much like the original Rambo, like, yeah, is really more of it's a guy, like it's a survivalist film. It's not Rambo. It's First,
they came
it's
back
first
and
Blood.
Kind of
Yeah. And it's a it's a post Vietnam War.
Exactly. Yeah, and that and that came out before Die Hard, I think.
I think we're kind of talking
I'm talking
more
about
like,
the sequels. I'm talking about casting someone that's huge in the role and they're supposed to be this big imposing person and like, wow, like that guy's gonna kick some ass.
We're really talking about Schwarzenegger.
Well, that's why it's interesting to look at especially Die Hard in the 80s and 90s movies as they evolved over those two decades and where they are now. It's interesting to see that, you know, McCain, even with this latest Die Hard, which is so far removed from the original that it's laughable. He still happened to have a decent, really good box office compared to the other two that just came out with The Last Stand for Schwarzenegger and Bullet to the Head for Stallone.
His box office was way under what it was supposed to do. They were projecting $40 million for the weekend. This is a disappointment.
Compared to those two, yeah.
But hey, but still it came in number one. And I think, I think, Dave, you touch on an interesting point. Bruce Willis has never gone away. He has made so many flops, but he can keep leading.
Keep going.
He can keep going, although he'll do – I think part of the flexibility of Bruce Willis is that he can just – he'll do anything. He won't do anything, but he can choose when to care and when to not care, which is frustrating because he can be a great actor when he wants to be. But then also he's like, well, maybe I'll just take a supporting role in this movie and it'll be like a smaller sort of indie film and he doesn't mind. Or then he'll be like, I'll do – what was it? Oh, gosh, the film he did with,
Death
like...
Death Becomes Her?
No, not Death Becomes Her. The one... He did, like, two movies with 50 Cent. And they both went, like, directly to DVD.
Yeah.
And so those kind of movies were...
I was going to say, like, Exit Wounds or something, but that's Steven Seagal. But yeah.
But you get... It was like... I forget. I can't pull it up right now, but... It's someone.
Exit Wounds was this like Ja Rule or who was it?
I don't even
know. DMX.
DMX and like Steven Seagal when Seagal really started to just tank.
How long was Steven Seagal really a success? Steven Seagal, you know, was Under Siege is Die Hard on a train or on a boat? Of those is on a train? Is it Under Siege or Under Siege 2?
I forget. I
think the sequel's on the boat. I think the first one's on a train. Okay. I'm not 100% sure though.
So, yeah, let's just – all right, we're going to change gears and just talk about Seagal for the next
Seagal.
Hour. but I will say, like, there were a lot of Schwarzenegger, they had sort of their own thing, but and Stallone, but you're right, their movies tanked. But Bruce Willis in a Die Hard film, yeah, it definitely performed under expectations, but they're going to be like, it's the number one film this weekend. I think the story would definitely be a little different had it been beaten by Safe Haven. By the way, the film I was thinking of was Set Up with 50 Cent. But also he did – I mean, you look at the films he did. He did a lot of stuff that went direct to DVD. There was that, Catch 44, Lay the Favorite basically went direct to DVD. Yeah. Although that's a supporting role. He's not the lead in that. Neither is he in Set Up, he isn't. In Catch 44, Cold Light of Day, he isn't. But he's doing these films and cashing paychecks. And yet he can still turn around. And he's like, he's going to be in Red 2. And I think Red 2 will probably be a hit. The first Red was a hit. Like, his name can – I don't want to say it can open films. But for the amount of flops that he has, I mean, just read through his filmography. And you look at all the films that just whiffed. He's
Mercury
a guy that
– Rising.
Oh, God. Mercury Rising or Last Man Standing or The Story of Us or The Jackal. But – oh, he gets to keep starring in films, and I don't know. He seems flop proof, if that makes any sense. Like,
can flop and he can come back.
He can just keep going. He keeps going. Yeah. I think I think maybe he just always makes sure he has a next film lined up. Like, there's just no way no one's going to turn away Bruce Willis. And as long as he keeps going, he is, in a way, John McClane. He's the fucking Energizer Bunny. Yeah. No matter how many flops he takes, he'll just keep coming back. Whereas if you notice Stallone and Schwarzenegger, they had these really long periods where they didn't make films. I mean, Schwarzenegger was running California, and Stallone just sort of kind of disappeared for a little while and then sort of came back with Rocky Balboa, Rambo, and then The Expendables. But you put him back in something like Bullet to the Head, and people are like, I don't care. Also, Bullet to the Head was barely marketed at all. I hear the film isn't good, but I don't even remember seeing a commercial for Bullet to the Head.
Yeah. Well, most of those January releases, they give them like 2 weeks of lead time.
Now, The Last Stand surprised me. That really, really surprised me. I thought The Last Stand was going to win the weekend easily.
See, that didn't surprise me because I feel like everyone likes to talk about how much they like love Schwarzenegger and like, oh, Schwarzenegger movies are going to be awesome. But I think when it comes down to it, like, are you going to go see the new Schwarzenegger movie this weekend? They're like,
it's not 1987.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a thing. Like, he's a thing. Like, everyone – it's in the zeitgeist. He's still a thing. Like, everyone's still, like, all about Schwarzenegger. But when it comes to – I don't remember how much money The Expendables 2 made, but I think it was – I mean, I know it was a hit, but I don't think it was, like, a massive success just because it had, like, Schwarzenegger coming back.
I think in a way you have to – you look at the Expendables films and you have to pile in that many stars because none of them could get a hit on their own.
Yeah.
Like, The Expendables is all about quantity. It's like, okay – here's Chuck Norris. For all the people who have an ironic appreciation of Chuck Norris, here you go. Actually, holy shit, Expendables 2, according to Box Office Mojo, cost $100 million and only pulled in 85 domestic, and then it pulled in 300 worldwide.
Yeah, I think the worldwide box office saves a lot of these guys.
Yeah, right. I know A Good Day to Die Hard, I think, is already at, like, I know it's really high worldwide, even though it didn't, like, if Safe Haven had opened on Friday instead of on Valentine's Day, I think it would have been a different story because, like, overall, including the – because both movies open on Valentine's Day. Right. Both movies, like, for the four-day weekend, Die Hard had 33 million and Safe Haven had 30 million, which is kind of embarrassing when you think of, like, it's a new Die Hard movie. Like, this movie is supposed to dominate the weekend.
I want to see – I'm checking right now. I like how we just do research in the middle of the podcast. Hey, guys, we know our shit. Type. But I want to see how much Live Free or Die Hard made on its opening weekend.
Who decided to choose, like, Valentine's Day weekend, A, as an opening day, and then as an opening weekend, too. This just – it feels like more of a summer movie. For as bad as it is, it definitely still has
I think Fox is like, we have better shit we want to put in the summer. I think Fox knew what they had,
sense,
and they're like, we don't want to waste the weekend on what we have right here. So you look at Live Free or Die Hard opened with $33 million when it opened in June.
Well, it had a four-day weekend.
It had a four-day weekend. So $33 million. It opened at number two on its opening weekend. So.
No, it made $38.2 million on its four-day weekend. And then this new one made $33 million.
Where the f- – I'm looking at Box Office Mojo.
Yeah, so am I.
Domestic summary, opening weekend, 33.
It's on their front page, Die Hard 5 versus Die Hard 4.
Oh, I'm looking at
– I'll just sit here while you two argue over Box Office.
I'm looking at – see, you're looking at the homepage. I'm looking at the actual page for Live Free or Die Hard, the individual page. This is fascinating to all our listeners. Let's stop this.
Yeah,
now. Jesus Christ.
Feel free to just join me and go.
Come back. What we're trying to say.
You guys want to go for a beer or something? we'll come back to these two later.
Everyone's abandoning us. Come back, Trumbor. A friend of mine actually asked, he's like, where's Dave been lately? I'm like, he doesn't care. No, it's because he doesn't give a shit. No, it was like our Oscar episode followed by something else where you were unavailable. But
this has been a rough start to the year just for movies for me too. Like,
oh,
I didn't have
rough
really high expectations
everyone.
For anything, but good God, it's just mind numbing.
It really has been. Genuine. I mean,
I was hoping there would be more surprises. And the sad thing is, okay, this new Die Hard got a B+ cinema score, which is ridiculous. But Beautiful Creatures had like way better reviews than all the others, and I've heard it's actually a pretty good movie, and it just bombed at the box office.
Yeah, tanked.
Nobody knows anything. It's always hard to know what's – I'm terrible at predicting box office. So all I'm saying is I do think that Fox was wise to at least open it here as kind of maybe a little bit of counter-programming, but mostly because the President's Day weekend is a thing. It's a weekend that people – that Studio C is like, it's a long weekend and we can exploit it. You know, we have an opportunity here to do something, and they want to take advantage of it. It's just that – and so for A Good Day to Die Hard, they probably felt this is the best it can do in 2013 at this point. Because I think it was a smart move. I think if you had put it in the summer, it would have been embarrassing in more ways than one. But let's just talk about how it's in film. Fuck it. I'm sort of – I don't know. The Die Hard legacy – you know,
it needs to die. This needs to be the last one.
You think this needs to be the last one?
Well, okay, Bruce Willis. I'm sorry to say the blame lies on Bruce Willis because he handpicked the directors for these last two movies, and he is the chief of this franchise, and he is the one who okays the script, and he chooses the directors, and I mean,
I agree. This should be the end of the Die Hard franchise. I was just thinking more of. This has been a very poorly disorganized podcast, and I apologize for that. I'm just sort of we got bogged down talking about box office numbers, and I feel we got away just a little bit from talking about the legacy of the franchise, because I wanted to say we don't really see Die Hard films anymore or anything like A Good Day to Die Hard. It's just an action film without anything supernatural happening.
Right.
And
I think part of that is, unfortunately, it's the curse of the sequels. Like you said, Matt, with the second one that came out, it was a retread. And that might have been one of the first ones that really started where if you just sort of retread over the same thing that worked the first time, audiences aren't going to respond to the same way. So now there's this idea that it has to be bigger, it has to be better, it has to be faster, louder, more explosions, more gunfire. And that just – it got absolutely out of control. And you can see that over the course of the 25 years of the Die Hard series from, you know, Die Hard up until this most recent one. You can't even compare the two of them anymore. You can't take somebody that's never seen them, make them watch the first one, make them watch the fifth one, and just say, what the fuck do you think has happened between these two movies? Because they're not even closely related, so far apart.
I mean, I was just even talking, I mean, not just in terms of this franchise, but just action films, because I look at I try to say, like, what has been, like, Die Hard, and maybe these, you know, White House Down or Olympus Has Fallen kind of films where it is just a person. I mean, it's a Secret Service agent both times?
Yeah.
That's reasonable. That's reasonable. But I'm thinking more like we want superheroes, something supernatural, or you go lower, sort of the lower end where it's not really an action film, but more of a crime.
Like contraband.
Yeah, it's a crime.
Stuff like that.
It's a crime thriller. It's not explosions. Yeah. It's not body count. It's a thriller, which is fine. Like, there's no thing. But no one would ever call Die Hard a crime thriller.
I mean, to be honest with you, The Last Stand was pretty close to that, at least as far as the protagonist side of it. Even on the villain side of it, too, even though it was kind of hokey. But that was the approach. It was just sort of this ex-LAPD guy who retires to the small town, and then bad guys show up at his door, and he has to get his ragtag bunch of blue-collar, you know, deputies together. That was the premise. And nobody cared.
Exactly.
So I feel like we've gotten to the point as audience members, just generally, that we've responded so well to a bigger and better sequel that, you know, there's a ceiling. There's got to be a ceiling. They can't just always get bigger and badder and louder, because eventually it's just noise. And I think that's where you've gotten with this last Die Hard and a lot of the movies that are out.
So there's sort of a ceiling there's a ceiling to the realism.
It's a rock and a hard place.
To how big it can go. I feel like if someone went in and pitched the first Die Hard today, the studio executives would say, okay, and what else? What else happens? What else is there? Are there aliens?
Exactly. There has to be aliens.
Is there a helicopter that comes and explodes the building?
Right.
Let's make it two helicopters. Are there... The closest thing I can think of this to Die Hard today is The Raid. You know, that's sort of like a modern sort of take on Die Hard.
I'd say that's a martial arts movie.
It's a martial arts film. And if you take say Dread, I would say Dread is sci-fi action.
Because The Raid
First
is very
all,
much – The Raid is action.
Wait, what?
It's all
– I'm definitely going to disagree with you that it's a martial arts film. You can have a film with martial arts elements doesn't make it a martial arts film. The only difference
– But if you have scenes centered entirely around a martial arts battle, it's a martial arts film.
It's a martial arts battle? Is that what it is? It wasn't a SWAT team that stormed an apartment?
There are entire set pieces devoted to people doing kung fu. and not kung fu. I know that. I don't know that, but whatever style of fighting they're doing, whatever style of fighting they're doing, I know it's not kung fu. Stop right there. Okay. Devoted to people just to showcasing martial arts. I think The Raid starts off as mostly an action film, but once it starts getting into machete land and two guys fighting in a room, I mean, it's all about the fight choreography. I think it's a martial arts film.
That's what I think delineates it, is because Die Hard is, it's plot driven and character driven, whereas The Raid, it has an interesting story, but it's very much.
Yeah, I'm not meaning to badmouth The Raid here. I just don't think it's a straight action film.
Haywire was a good martial arts film too that I just saw the other day. That was kind of a blue collar martial arts film with martial arts in it. That was good.
Yes, because that. See, that's interesting. Is Haywire a martial arts film? No, I'm seriously considering it.
Talk about A Good Day to Die Hard now, but we're running out of time.
No, I wouldn't.
Well, no, Haywire. I would say Haywire is like a fighting movie. I would go so, because it's centered around the action, like the fight sequences are the. Like, those are the beats instead of, like, story and plot twists.
Interesting.
You guys are just cracking. I've never seen a movie pitched as the genre of fighting movie. You're just cracking me up over here. That's all.
I believe the film Fighting was pitched as a fighting film.
Was it
fighting? Well, I wouldn't say that as – I mean, if you were saying that, like, we're wrong that The Raid is a martial arts movie and that the Haywire should be – categorized as a martial arts movie, I wouldn't say Haywire.
Actually, you know what? I think we should just stop right here because we're getting into a stupid semantic argument, and we lost half of our listeners arguing over a page on Box Office Mojo. We're listening to like half a person who's decided they're listening in their car and they've just decided to drive off a fucking bridge rather than keep
You're
listening.
You're welcome,
to
person.
And that's how we claimed our last listener. All right, let's talk about A Good Day to Die Hard, a film that was universally reviled to an astonishing extent. Oh my god, like people, I don't know
only
if people
critics,
liked
though.
What?
Only by critics.
But that's what I'm saying. Like, I mean, audiences, I'm just saying by critics just to sort of see it across the board and also in a way that people clearly cared. I think that's sort of what you could feel with it, is that it wasn't like people, you know, people can dismiss Hansel and Gretel Windhunters. They don't give a shit. They had no expectations, whatever. And I don't think people even had good expectations for A Good Day to Die Hard. Like, I didn't sense a lot of, like, Prometheus-level excitement over this one, you know? There wasn't. It was just, like, people were like, okay, maybe it'll be good. Maybe. No. But when it came, I think people just, like, they know that Die Hard legacy, and they just feel a little pissed off at it, that this is where, Adam, as you say, it's over. It needs to be over. This should be the last one, because for so many reasons, Bruce Willis has been a poor steward of the franchise. He doesn't even really look like he's in fat fighting shape anymore. I hate to say it. He seemed like he at least was having fun on this one more than Live Free or Die Hard, where he seemed kind of bored. Which was, again, surprising, because Adam, as you said, he chose the director. So he's the one who chose to make this film. So, again, I don't know why he would put that aside, but whatever. Oh, my God. Do you guys – I can't even describe the plot of A Good Day to Die Hard. I don't even really know what happens.
Don't you have, like, an explosion cue on your soundboard that you can just sum it up with? Oh, that was weak.
We don't pay for a lot on this show. This show costs $3 to produce.
You just lost our half of a listener.
Thanks for joining us, nobody. How will we even call people back at the end of this? I think this is funny. I think this podcast is good because it's a train wreck, much like A Good Day to Die Hard. After this, we're just going
to
start.
You want me to take a stab at the plot, the lack of plot?
Sure, sense. And then let's all just take a walk to Chernobyl.
Yeah, that sounds good. Well, there's half of the plot right there.
Go ahead,
basically, John McClane flies to Russia to see what the hell is up with his son, who's in all sorts of trouble. His son is Jack McClane, or John McClane Jr., as played by Jai Courtney, who actually I thought did okay in this, but
his
we can get
giant
that
head was not bad.
Giant head. So he flies to Russia to sort of rescue his son, who he finds has just been arrested on some pretty nasty stuff. Meanwhile, his son is actually a government operative, who is trying to rescue an informant, rescue somebody that has some information that we don't quite know what it is at the beginning of the movie, and it just gets worse as the movie goes on. But he's got some pretty high-level information about the Russian government and things that have happened in the Russian government's past and a cover-up. It completely just turns into a mess from there. There's a lot of really bad twists and turns and a lot of really awkward daddy issues that come up pretty much every other scene.
And even before that's you're giving it way too much credit for making sense before then. Like, just help me out here. So John McClane, he's going to, like, his son has just been arrested by the Russian authorities. So a cop from New York who has no authority whatsoever flies over there and to do what? He's going to get his son out. He's going to say hi. He's going to, like, he doesn't seem to have much of a plan.
Just get in a cab. Don't worry about. Does he even have like a bag with him?
He does have a bag. He does have. He has like
a carry.
He has a carry on. He has like a. No, he had a duffel. He had like a duffel bag.
Duffel.
He had a duffel for his to go to Russia. He took a duffel bag.
Seriously, that's the thing. Like, oh my god, my son's in a Russian prison, and I'm gonna get this file that tells me why he's in there and what he's gonna do. Like, all right, see ya. I'm gonna go over there by myself and just hang out.
Wait, did Bruce Willis even say he was getting? Did Bruce Willis even say he was getting a file?
He got one.
He didn't have a plan to get his son out.
No, he was just going over there. Say, hey, what's up? What you doing over here in Russia?
He's gonna make friends with this cabbie, and he's gonna inform me on everything that happens in Russian politics and law enforcement.
Russian cabbie is very useful. I think that's unfair to the Russian cabbie populace. Dave, don't be dismissive, because that guy is our last listener.
You just lost our Russian cabbie.
That's great. I love that guy. That guy is actually listening, but that was the extent of my.
So anyway, so he gets there, and then this notion, like, he gets there, and here's something else I didn't understand. So Jai Courtney gets arrested because he shoots this guy in a club. Who did he shoot? Who was that guy?
Random mid-level mob boss kind of thing. That's what I took from it.
He's like, oh my god, it's edited together so poorly, and he's just like, here's some guy, and you don't know who's important, you don't know who Jai Courtney really is at that point, and it's just some guy shoots a Russian guy in the chest at a nightclub, and then goes to prison, and now he's being tried at the same time as this famous Russian, like, I don't understand, how are they connected to be brought into the room at the same time?
That makes no sense.
Why would Jai Courtney be getting tried at the same time as, like, this famous political prisoner?
Well, he wasn't coming in to be tried, he was coming in to testify.
He was like, if you get me in the same courtroom as this guy, then I'll say that he forced me to kill whatever the Russian guy's name was, which I don't know. Whatever, I don't know how they connect.
I don't know how that. Okay, so
they do things differently in Russia.
They do things differently in Russia, and I didn't even bother.
I rolled my eyes.
There was also a point where their hands are bound, and this had to be explained to me. Their hands are bound, and I knew that Jai Courtney had like a knife in his boot, right? He had a knife, and he was going to cut himself loose, but he cuts himself loose.
Gun.
See, I didn't know it was a knife gun. Like,
oh, you didn't see? No, he had a five or six shot.
I just saw the knife, and like even that's confusing because some people are like, no, the knife is also a gun, and I'm like, it's a knife gun. I'm like, no, that can't be right because that's not a real fucking thing. That doesn't exist.
No, they foreshadow it pretty heavily.
They do. Oh god, maybe my brain was just shutting off.
There's like close-up shots of it like twice for like no
reason.
He's
like loading it and checking it and.
I would say okay. Yeah, I still don't. But when it plays out in the scene, because it's playing out in a wide shot, it's difficult to see what's happening. I think that's where my confusion is, because like it's in a wide shot and you see him pull back, and then all of a sudden what he was cutting his hands with is now he's shooting people down, and it all happens really quickly. And again, I don't believe knife guns exist. So
they had some cool toys in this. They did have some. They definitely had money to play with. I think half of it went to.
They had money to play with. Really, it looked pretty. I don't know. It actually kind of feels like a cheap film, to be honest.
I don't know for the. I think the
digital effects look cheap. I think the fact that you only have one. It's not like all of the characters are pretty much unknown actors, except for Courtney and a brief Mary Elizabeth Winstead cameo.
Cole Hauser.
And poor Cole. Wait, we're deciding Cole Hauser as a name now?
I mean, audience is recognized, like, as opposed to the rest
of the absolutely. I know, and I think that says something. The fact that I'm like, oh, hey, I recognize Cole Hauser and nobody else. I mean, I get it. You're like, you want Russian actors, but at some point, I wonder if they approached Peter Stormare, and he's like, no, I have my dignity.
You can't imagine Stormare ever turning down a role.
Exactly.
Like that.
That's my point.
I would love to see him in it, actually. I love Stormare. He's crazy.
He is crazy.
He's crazy.
He's so crazy.
Speaking of the money on display, the giant set piece of this movie is a car chase that is completely unintelligible. I was just waiting for it to be over because I didn't know what the
on,
fuck was going
on forever.
Because John Moore doesn't know how to shoot action, and you don't know where anyone is in relation to each other.
Yeah, there are only these.
There's no sense of like intensity or like anticipation or like, oh, I hope he gets by this. You're just like, all right, there's John McClane's face. There's a car that's exploding on something, and whatever. When's this over? I'm getting a headache.
Also, and John McClane has been in two car accidents and has emerged with nary a scratch.
No blood. Zero blood.
Which is, again, that goes to the fact that, like, the people who made this film clearly had never seen a Die Hard film before.
Exactly.
Although, part of me wonders if Bruce Willis was like, yeah, I don't want to get injured because I don't want to have to go through the hassle of getting the makeup put on me again.
Like, I mean, he does that at the end, but it's like one scene at the end. Yeah.
Right.
That's about it.
But it takes a long time for him to get injured, I assume it's because, again, he doesn't want to have to put on blood makeup and sit in the trailer and waste time. I mean, not
I
waste
they
time.
Have to, yeah, they have to get shot by, like, a military helicopter and then fall off of a building, I think, before they get any blood.
Exactly. And yeah. So, already, but again, when you're letting Bruce Willis dictate what's happening, and I'm not saying that's for sure what happened, but either way, when you emerge from two... they're not like fender benders for people who haven't seen the movie. They're
no.
full on he should be dead car accidents, and he emerges like, huh, I'm a little shaken there. All right, hop in the next car to destroy it. And also,
yeah, and hijack like a Russian civilian too, and then like berate him.
Yeah, you asshole. I'm trying to hijack your car, even though I have no authority here. Like, we accept that in America, like, that's just a thing. Like, oh, he's a cop, he holds up his badge, you commandeer the vehicle. That's just a thing. But yeah. You can't do that in someone else's country.
In Soviet Russia.
Exactly. The other thing is, so, that really bothered me, even more than, like, the fact that he's not getting injured, is how reckless he is with, like, the survival of other people. And again, people try to, like, throw this one at me. I didn't go into the comments for too long, but someone was like, Die Hard of the Vengeance, he's dying, you know, he's driving through a park and being reckless there. I'm like, first off, he's honking. Second, maybe that mime. But third, he's not doing it to, like... His purpose there is to make sure that he gets somewhere so that a bomb doesn't blow up. So he's trying to avoid as many people as he can, except that mime, and then so he can save more lives. What is he doing in A Good Day to Die Hard? He wants to have a chat with his son, which is apparently enough of a pretense so he can drive
over. Where are you
going?
Come back. Jack, come here. Hey, hold on. Come here.
Hey, hold
Jack.
On.
He's driving over cars when people are in them.
And then apologizing out the window.
Exactly, in a language that is unintelligible to the people he's yelling it at. Oh, God. And this is all within the first half hour of the film. And thankfully, this
is... It actually
gets
worse for people who haven't seen
it. It gets much worse. For example, they go to Chernobyl without suits.
Because why not?
Why not? My friend Kurt and I were joking, where he leaned over to me. It's like Die Hard 6 is going to be his last remaining white blood cell fending off into itself. And I was like, Die Hard with chemotherapy. I mean, they went into Chernobyl without suits. It's just at that point.
Oh, no. They had a machine full of...
Well, that's what I was saying. Deus Ex Machina is Skip Woods' best friend, because every single thing in this movie has like an, oh, that's a problem? All right, here we go.
What did they have?
There's an actual line where she was like, no, the neutralizes the radioactivity. Just trust me. It's like she was talking to the audience.
Oh, they say that Chernobyl's not radioactive anymore.
God.
Okay, I'm convinced.
She just used her gun to just fix it.
She was using that stuff from Ghostbusters too. It was the positively charged ooze.
Oh, was the whole site of Chernobyl? I'm confused. Was the entire site of Chernobyl not radioactive, or did she just make some of it not radioactive?
Just that one little room.
So they're still fucked because they walked into the place without suits. So Bruce Willis and Jai Courtney are still fucked. So they're gonna die horribly of cancer. Like, that's the thing. So at that point, you're just
the sixth title. Yeah,
die hard with cancer. I'm sorry. It's they did it. They made the movie. I mean, honestly, how hard is it to just put your two lead actors in radioactive suits? Are you that fucking lazy? I mean, or just not have it at Chernobyl. Oh God, I'm getting angry again. Why?
It's the same reason that, like, so they had this one random big Russian dude like walking around with Russian like CCCP tats.
I love that dude because it's like I love that dude because he gets those tattoos, right? And I bet when he gets them, he's like, "This is going to be great. Yeah. The USSR is going to stand forever." And then it becomes Russia, and he's like, "Fuck, my tattoos don't make sense anymore."
I was happy that the shirtless Nazi from Indiana Jones got a job in this movie.
Oh, yeah, that was good for him. Did he fall into
it? But they didn't even fight him. It's like, if you're going to have a giant dude, and then, okay, you're going to have his shirt off to show his tats, at least have him and, like, Jai Courtney fight, you know.
Yeah, I was waiting for something to happen.
No, it's okay. Jai Courtney fights an old man, so that's just as good.
Yeah, he sure does, and he gets his ass kicked.
Gets his ass kicked by an old man.
that was my reaction to the entire movie.
Bigger daddy issues in this movie. I want to know who it is. I want to know if it's Willis, if it's Moore, if it's Skip Woods, or if it's just everybody all together. Because every other scene was just like daddy issue, daddy issue.
And why does he hate his dad? My dad was too busy being a hero.
I think this brings us back to the Die Hard franchise as a whole, though, because Die Hard, the first Die Hard was just him alone, and I believe the second one was too. I haven't seen that one.
Yeah,
in a
it's
long
him
time.
Alone. I mean, he gets help from people, but
yeah, but Die Hard with a Vengeance, his chemistry with Sam Jackson was great, and they were like, okay, we'll use that, and we did it. They did it in Live Free or Die Hard with a comic foil, so I guess they just assumed like, oh, we've got to have somebody with him this time. I guess it'll be his son. Like, oh, that'll make for some big emotional pull for the audience. Nope.
It wasn't even just confined to them, too. There was a weird dynamic between, well, two of the other characters that we won't.
Yeah, there was like a parental thing.
By the way, the film has like three or four villains. I don't know who the main villain is. I kind of guess I do. It made me crave for like, oh, thank goodness Live Free or Die Hard has a villain I can point to. Whereas A Good Day to Die Hard, and how hard is it to fuck that up? To just say my action movie is going to have one villain. To just, instead of like misdirect and woohoo, you didn't see that one coming.
Yeah,
I'd like,
rather have a caricature of a bad villain than have like just a menagerie of just really shitty half villains throughout the
movie. I love it when like one I forget the actor's name, but he's the guy who kind of looks like he's the villain in the commercials. He's the one eating the carrot, and he's like,
yeah,
and he's like, but you don't see in the trailer, like he's dancing and stuff. Like, it makes no sense. He's like, I'm gonna dance and I'm eating carrots, and what?
It's like he tried to pick like these weird eccentric like quirks. But they just did not work at all.
Because there's no
really
character
awkward.
There.
He's completely irrelevant.
He is irrelevant because he's not really the lead guy. He's just a guy. Oh, God. Everything we say about A Good Day to Die Hard should be just followed with, just like this, the painful size. But we care. See, that's the thing. We do care about Die Hard, about John McClane. And I think there was the potential there for this film. It's just feels like maybe at some point, I don't think anyone, if you were to just say after Live Free or Die Hard, we're going to make a fifth Die Hard film, I think the reaction would have been like, okay, let's try to pick it back up again. Let's try to pick it back up again. And then the second you hear Skip Woods is writing it, you're like, nope, good day, thank you. And it just went downhill from there. So now if someone's like, let's make a sixth Die Hard, I'm like, nope. No, we're done. I've had all the Die Hard.
Yeah, the only way it would be decent is if somebody that has actually either followed the franchise or made the effort to go back to see what they made the original one or, you know, 1 and 3, worthwhile. That's the only way that another one should ever be made.
The only way I will see another Die Hard film is if John McTiernan directs it, and even that's a stretch.
He's in jail.
Exactly, and so and that's he's why it's a stretch. He is unavailable for the moment due to being incarcerated.
That's good creative material, though. I'm sure you can get some good insider information there.
But if you look at, I mean, Bruce Willis, I just feel like he does, like, even if they did make a sixth one, he wouldn't, I feel like he's the one choosing.
Exactly,
based off of the world,
right.
And he chose John Moore based off of Max Payne, like, what is he thinking?
Yeah, exactly.
He's not choosing anyone interesting.
And then that brings the question, can you make a Die Hard film without Bruce Willis?
I'm sure it'll be rebooted.
It will be rebooted. I mean, it will probably, everything gets rebooted at some point. But my question
is, it won't feel like Die Hard.
I think, and see, that's what I find interesting. Another thing I find interesting about Die Hard is that an actor is so tied to the to the property, that if someone were to say I'm making a Die Hard film without Bruce Willis, that seems
it's
tough.
Like making Indiana Jones with Shia LaBeouf.
Exactly. Exactly. And that's very tough to do. So, I don't know. I bet they'll reboot it at some point. But
yeah, there was no – I mean, this movie at least didn't really have, like, a handoff either. Like, so you could have thought, like, oh, maybe he's going to kind of hand the franchise off to his son. Did not feel like that at all.
It's okay.
So I don't even know if that was –
it's not like, oh, man, Jai Courtney really has the power to put the franchise on his shoulders and run with it. Like, I didn't come away with that at all. I just
– No, definitely.
Let's talk about other action films that we should – hey, we've told everyone don't see A Good Day to Die Hard. And by everyone, I mean nobody because no one's listening to this goddamn show anymore. But, you know, let's just go through the motions, much like they did in A Good Day to Die Hard, but even worse. Oh, God. Adam, let's recommend some movies. Let's tell people what they should see. Adam, what do you got for us?
I am recommending one of the many movies that came after Die Hard that was described as Die Hard on a blank, and this is Die Hard on a Plane, and it's the 1996 action movie Executive Decision. It stars Kurt Russell, Halle Berry, John Leguizamo, and briefly Steven Seagal.
We remember that scene. Yeah.
When it was marketed, it looks like Steven Seagal is like a supporting character in this movie, but he is quickly dispatched within the first 10 minutes.
Thank you, spoiler alert.
But basically, there's it kind of has some weird parallels to 9/11. That's kind of not very great, or not great, but kind of interesting. But basically, a plane has been hijacked by some Chechen. I think it's Chechen mafians. I'm not sure exactly who has hijacked it, but it's obviously foreign nationals, and they contact the U.S. to say that they are keeping control of the airplane until a political prisoner is released, someone they want. And so we come back to like the Pentagon, and they've amassed kind of a group of people, and Kurt Russell is among them. And he plays a U.S. Navy graduate who's basically just a consultant for the U.S. Army's intelligence. And they realize that they actually have a bomb on the plane, and they plan to exploded over United States, whether this guy is released or not. They believe that they already have a way to get this guy out. So they decide they need to put a team together and get on that plane and defuse the bomb, as you will. And Steven Seagal is he's a lieutenant colonel, and he's, you know, the big guy. He's going to lead this mission. And they get on a plane, and they get up there, and they're in a stealth plane, obviously. And they get underneath the aircraft and board the aircraft. And Steven Seagal is quickly dispatched, and it's up to Kurt Russell, who is just a consultant for the intelligence community. He's not a Navy SEAL or anything, to kind of lead the way. Oliver Platt is on board. He's an engineer. John Leguizamo plays kind of like another operative. Halle Berry is a flight attendant on the plane who's kind of helping them, and they're kind of weaving in and out of the kind of not attic space, but I don't know what you call it, the space on the plane that's not in the place where all the passengers are. And so they're kind of trying to figure out who's the trigger man on the plane and how to defuse the bomb. And it's very much, you know, Kurt Russell is the guy that he's just an every guy. He doesn't have these special skills, and it's up to him to try and figure out how to defuse the situation. And it's a pretty fun action movie. It's you know, got a good cast. J.T. Walsh is in it. It's one of those classic 90s action movies where it's a little over the top. It was produced by Joel Silver. But it's not played like super straight and super realistic. There are some like a few kind of lighter moments and stuff like that. So it's a lot of fun. Definitely check it out. Executive Decision.
Okay. Dave, what about you?
Well, since we lamented the movies that sort of had the everyman blue collar action hero without all the over the top, you know, special training and weapons and all that stuff, we're going to go with 1973's, 73, Walking Tall. It's a Phil Carlson picture. It's actually based off of a real guy with a crazy name. His name is Buford Pusser. That's his actual name. He was a sheriff in Tennessee who basically returned to his hometown that he grew up in, ran to be a local sheriff, and he almost lost his life a number of times. The guy was like stabbed and shot like 6 or 7 times trying to clean up corruption in a small town. There's a lot of prostitution and gambling, moonshining, all kinds of crazy stuff going down. And this guy was basically like a one-man wrecking crew to try to clean the town up. So Walking Tall was made sort of not in his memory, because he was still alive at the time. It was made based on his life. It stars Joe Don Baker, who actually I think just starred in Mud with Matthew McConaughey, and might be better known as, I think he was the governor in the recent, was it Dukes of Hazzard remake? I think he was the governor in there. So Joe Don Baker, Elizabeth Hartman as his wife Pauline, and Leif Garrett. There's some other, not a lot of really recognizable names in this. But that kind of plays to its strengths because it was very, very stripped down to sort of character-driven drama. It was still a thriller. There's still a lot of action to be found. Actually, he has a lot of just one-on-one fights with the ne'er-do-wells in his town. He has a wrestling background. He's got actually a little bit of martial arts training, which is funny that we mentioned that earlier. He also just carries around a baseball bat with him and just beats the shit out of people that act up. But it's incredibly stripped down. You really want to get behind this guy because he's just an underdog and he's fighting for the good of his town and for the good people that are actually in the town. So it's fun to just watch him go in and, you know, sort of have this reckless abandon, but he's got no superpowers. He's not jumping off of buildings. He's just kind of cleaning up the streets. They actually remade this in 2004 with Dwayne Johnson, The Rock. Similar story, but it definitely lost a lot of those elements that made the original one so good, especially because it's got that 70s kind of gritty texture and feel to it. And when you start to look into this guy's background, again, Buford Pusser, you should watch it just because of that name. Once you start to get into his background and realize that most of this was actually a true story, it makes the movie even better. So 1973's Walking Tall.
Okay. I will finish up with 1987's Hard Ticket to Hawaii. A bad film like A Good Day to Die Hard, but at least it's an entertaining film. This film was brought to my attention via the magic of YouTube as various clips were shown to me that were just delightfully stupid and over the top, and I was like, I had to see this whole movie. And it didn't disappoint. Oh gosh, what in the way of the plot is there? It's written and directed by Andy Sidaris, who did this whole thing called the Triple B series, and there are 12 of these movies, and they're all kind of the same thing, where it's hot chicks. They're actually usually former Playboy playmates or penthouse pets, and basically what I love about this film is that it feels like it was written by a 13-year-old boy. Like, yeah, there's like this guy trying to get some diamonds back, and whatever. But there's also a mutant snake loose on the island. It takes place in Hawaii. Someone's trying to get diamonds. There's a mutant snake. But mostly it's like, I want to see hot women topless. I want to see explosions. I want to see a mutant snake. I want to see horrible quips. I think the film intends for them to be funny, but they're just horribly bad. Like, one of my favorite lines is this guy's having sex. Also, it's not softcore porn. Like, I just want to make that clear. And to the point where you don't even know, like, I was watching, like, are they having sex? Like, the position they're in doesn't look like any kind of sex whatsoever, but he seems to be enjoying it. I'm not really sure what's going on. But at one point, you know, this woman asked, like, the lead guy, something. And he's like, you know what they say, one man's dream is another man's free lunch. And she goes, you bastard. I'm like, what the fuck does that even mean? Did you just call her a whore? I don't know what that means in context. Of course, I spent most of the film trying to figure out the profession of the two lead actresses. Like, we see them and they're dressed like no profession. Like, they're in Hawaii, but they're wearing, like, you know, short shorts and sort of these, you know, khaki vest with cut-off sleeves, and their job is to, like, transport cargo, but they're also kind of, like, tour guides, but they're like, we have to call this in. Like, you don't know if they're cops. And eventually, at the end of the film, we figure out that one of them was a civilian, and then one was an agent. What kind of agent, you ask? A federal agent. What does that mean? And the film just, oh, it's a federal agent. What, of course, why not? And, oh my god, it's so dumb, but so much fun. And I love it because, like, a rocket launcher is used for everything. It's used for, like, blowing up a person and a helicopter separately. It is a rocket launcher will give you just the right amount of explosion depending on the need you have for it in a Hard Ticket to Hawaii. But I love these sort of good bad movies, so maybe that's just me, but I found it pretty entertaining. So I recommend checking it out, but before you do, just hop on YouTube and type in Hard Ticket to Hawaii, and you'll watch these clips, and you'll be like, yeah, I do want to see the rest of this film. Those aren't the only two good scenes, although they are among the best. All right. Wow, this is going to be a podcast. Jesus Christ.
This has been
a podcast. Oh, goodness.
It's indicative of the movie that we were...
It really is. I think we did right by A Good Day to Die Hard. But we're going to bring it back, people. We're going to bring it slightly back.
What's next?
What's next is we're going to be doing a special Oscar podcast, so Dave is going to be like, fuck all y'all.
Out.
Trumbore, out. But we're going to be back with Sasha Stone. We're going to be doing a special recording this Wednesday, so it'll be either up Wednesday night or Thursday morning, so people have the time to listen to it before the Oscars, which premiere on Sunday, next Sunday, the 24th. So it's been a crazy Oscar season, and I'm really looking forward to talking about it since so many of the races are still pretty unclear. This could be a fun year if you're having an Oscar pool. So I would recommend tuning into that. If anyone is still listening to this thing, good Lord. We're professionals. I promise we'll do better. You can keep up with this podcast on Twitter by following us on Twitter. My Twitter handle is Matt Goldberg. Adam, where can we find you?
At Adam Chitwood.
And Dave?
At Dr. Claw, MD.
All right, thanks for listening, everyone, and be sure to come back later this week when we'll be talking about the Oscars.